Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today's podcast features Chief Investment Officer Andrew Marchese. Andrew is also Portfolio Manager of Fidelity Canadian Disciplined Equity Fund. Andrew recaps some of the trends that impacted markets in 2020 and will discuss what to expect in 2021. This includes reflecting on the rotation from long-duration growth to short-duration growth and more cyclical-oriented and value stocks, which started in September and accelerated in Q4 2020. Andrew also shares with host Pamela Ritchie how Fidelity Canada's portfolio managers and analysts, despite working remotely since mid-March 2020, have maintained the learning-through-osmosis feel of the office. This podcast was recorded on January 6th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Welcome, Andrew. Great to see you again. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Pamela. Great to be here.
Great to have you join us. We're going to begin with the minutia because we are looking at these headlines and we need you to interpret them a little bit. So here we are in the midst of getting election results from the Georgia race in the United States. Investors seem to have taken an unofficial conclusion at this point and piled it into a bit of a reflation trade. Is that what you're seeing right now?
Yeah, I think the reflation trade, the rotation from long duration growth to short duration growth, you know, more cyclical oriented and value, you know, things like autos, industrials, material stocks, that started kind of in September. You started to see some of that rotation occur then, really got kickstarted and accelerated through Q4. And now, again, we're seeing it kind of today. As it relates to the election, I think you're seeing things in renewable energy really get going, and there's been a lot of speculation built into that and higher prices as a result. The belief that monetary and fiscal policy in the U.S. will continue to be accommodative, and that will further fuel, you know, kind of that rotation, as I talked about, from long duration growth, higher multiple stocks to those cheaper stocks that rely on economic tailwinds and tend to be shorter cycle in nature.
And I mean, we'll point to what we saw yesterday in the oil price because of a move by Saudi Arabia, and maybe you can sort of take a look at that for us. But, you know, all of the things that we're talking about here, a more cyclical trade, if you will, are sort of the Canada trade. I mean, is it going too far to look at it that way?
No, I think, you know, Canada, obviously, with a high constituency in material stocks, gold stocks, oil, a robust financial sector, or, you know, and even a lot of small to mid-cap industrial names that participate globally, all are naturally beneficiaries of that. So you will see that emerging markets also kind of play into that as well. And I think the expectation for lower rates eventually leading to reflation and inflation. And you're seeing that somewhat in the rise in 10-year bond yields in the U.S. and the decline of the U.S. trade-weighted dollar. All of that trade is correlated to degrees. So when you see these two things from a macroeconomic standpoint, a weaker U.S. trade-weighted dollar and, you know, 10-year bond yields backing up with the expectation of further economic growth globally, markets like Canada, Australia, the emerging markets are usually beneficiaries thereof.
Now, where are we in a cycle here? When we spoke a year ago, actually, you know, we were kind of at the end of a bull market, and you were bringing some thoughts about a much more balanced approach. This is in January of last year, because that was the end of a market. Where are we now?
Yeah, I think the discussion about having a barbelled approach to one's portfolio probably is even more prescient at this point in time. So a year ago, I was talking about the fact that we were come through a 10-year period of time where growth had dominated over value. The global pandemic hit. Obviously, the market declined sharply in through March. For at least that first quarter to quarter and a half coming out of it, large cap and to a lesser degree, small cap growth in the U.S. was the best performing style and area of the market. And then, as I mentioned, the handoff started to occur somewhat in September. And I talked about back in January having a little bit more of a balance from a style perspective, growth and value. So a barbelled approach to one's portfolio, greater diversification, because you had come through a 10-year period of time, whereas if your portfolio was fairly narrow and concentrated around one region, i.e. the U.S., and number two, around large cap, long duration growth, you won handsomely. The likelihood of that continuing for the next 10 years is probably pretty small. So you were starting to see some remnants of, you know, I think very accommodative monetary policy being built. We had come through a period of time where the Federal Reserve cut rates by about 75 basis points to stave off a further slowdown. And then with the global pandemic, you've had more liquidity in the marketplace than we've ever seen. It's moved up exponentially. All the more reason, I think, to get a little bit more balanced and diversified in one's portfolio, because if we look out over a multi-year basis, and I talked about this 12 months ago, the potential for an increase in inflation, not necessarily this year, but the years ahead, rises. And I think to offset some of that, and you had some pretty cheap valuations for some of the value securities, not en masse, but for some of them back in March, you know, diversification would have been your friend. And I think it will continue to be your friend going forward. And I think, you know, that also means, you know, gold has gone up, Bitcoin's gone up exponentially. People are looking for ways to diversify their portfolios away from the traditional equity and fixed income balanced portfolio. I think a lot of that is because of the monetary environment we're really in.
Well, how does Fidelity help you do that? I mean, because as you're saying, these are, there's some different strategies in there that you can employ. So how do you speak to that?
Yeah, at Fidelity, we have a great collection of growth investors, value investors. I think we have a number of portfolios and portfolio managers who manage in a core vein, so really don't lean their portfolio one way or another by style, but aim to really capture a lot of the excess returns via stock selection. I think, you know, we have sector specific portfolios like Natural Resources Fund or Communication Services and Technology Funds. I think we also have liquid alternatives products that we recently launched back in October that help generate returns that are lowly or decorrelated from general market returns. So I think there's a lot of ways to build in diversification into one's overall portfolio using a suite of those products.
You manage all sorts of portfolio managers, all those different offerings, as you suggested, to traders, analysts. People are obviously not working in the office these days. How do you keep sort of the collegial, Fidelity is known for sort of not having walls between people and everyone hanging out to an extent in between moments of important trade and so on. How do you keep that going when you're all in your houses or apartments?
Yeah, I think one thing that's vitally important to maintaining in this type of work from home environment is that aspect of the office where you learn a lot through osmosis or just bumping into people or walking over to somebody's desk and that general learning that takes place. So when we went to a work from home structure in March of last year, my goal was to try to replicate that as best you can. Now, it requires you to be a little bit more formal or prescriptive or scheduled, if you will, in doing that. But I think our team rallied together really, really well to make sure that we're conversing you know, in person as a large group of people sharing ideas above and beyond what we would typically do in our previously scheduled team meetings. And I think by doing that, we maintain the flow of information really well and just making sure also people are just in a good state of mind, just generally, which is obviously a concern that everybody has during this period of time. And I think the organization, Fidelity as a whole, has done a really good job of paying mind and attention to people's well-being, making sure we're all in good shape and focused on our job, but also in, you know, like I said, in good spirits as best you can in dealing with whatever we have to deal with in our personal lives as we're all kind of locked down in this environment. And I think that's gone exceedingly well. If I look back on the last 9 to 10 months, the organization has behaved tremendously. It's an A++. Our team in Toronto and Montreal, investment team, has done exceptionally well. We had a really good year from a portfolio perspective, but more, even more importantly, I think the flow of information, the dialogue, the ability to reach out to our clients, the responsiveness to questions on behalf of all parties was exceptional. And I don't see there's any reason why we can't keep that going. And I think the largest reason for that, in addition to everything I just mentioned, is the fact that we've had remarkably low turnover in our team. You know, on the investment side, we haven't had anybody leave the organization for over 9 years, going on 10. And I think it's that rapport that you have with anybody, everybody, those long-term professional relationships that allow you to thrive in this environment. And I think, you know, and I think the numbers bear that out.
It's, I mean, that's sort of astonishing, actually, just to hear that particular statistic. I want to go back to what you're mentioning about early cycle. And, you know, early cycle can be kind of fascinating because there's so many options on some level. But one of the options you've mentioned before should not be sitting in cash. And, you know, just kind of go back through the reasons why this is the moment where you actually really do not want to be sitting in cash.
Yeah, I think it's a good sense to always kind of try to see the forest for the trees. And for those of you who have heard me speak before, you know, back in 2018 and 19, I think I and other members of our team were getting a little more nervous about where we were in the cycle because you saw some forms of tightening come in. And you know that anytime there's tightening from a monetary or fiscal perspective, the economies globally tend to slow, and that puts equities at greater risk. Well, you know, and you can keep going and keep going until you just short circuit the cycle, and then risk assets reprice, and sometimes very quickly. We've certainly seen that over the last two cycles. Now you sit back, we've had the global pandemic, central banks have come to the rescue, fiscal policy has become quite accommodative, and the market retrenchment has now moved off the bottom considerably. Now, as long as we remain accommodative, I think what you will see then still to come from an economics perspective is consumer spending should begin to increase. You know, balance sheets across the world from a consumer standpoint are actually quite good. Even in Canada and Australia, where I wouldn't put them quite in that camp, they've gotten better. So that's really positive. The next point will probably be CapEx. We haven't seen any CapEx yet. Some right. equities are starting to kind of anticipate that through higher equity prices, but we haven't seen it. So that's still to come. So it you know, I think volatility is going to be here to stay. There's no question about that, because a lot of the moves, as I just illustrated, have been predicated about currencies and interest rates. And, you know, there'll be days that we wake up where you might hear headline news about the Fed thinking of changing course, or, you know, things like this, which from a macroeconomic standpoint causes risk assets, at least in the short term, to reprice. I would urge, you know, investors not to get shaken out by that. So you can see a retrenchment, a small retrenchment in the market in any given week or any given month. That's normal. But if you look at the length of cycles, investment cycles tend to be anywhere from 5 to 10 years. Mm. Theoretically, right. And so, you know, we're kind of in, you know, kind of month 10 of all this, really. So, you know, I would say that focus more on the active return basis going forward, as opposed to what the markets are doing on a day-to-day basis. Because I think, as we see every cycle, the first year of a bull market is basically rising tides tend to raise all boats, more or less. But it's really about the price moving before the earnings show up. So you get huge multiple expansion. That's kind of what we've seen over the last 9 months now. Then the earnings going to have to come to fruition. And that's where active managers, people like Fidelity, really need to shine. Because I think for those companies that meet or exceed earnings and cash flow estimates going forward, those stocks will continue to be rewarded, while those that do not, they will give back some of their price gains that have occurred over the last 9 months. So I think this point, in as we kind of transition through this year, I think probably towards the back half of the year, earnings are going to become more and more important. They do have to show up because we've had that move off the bottom in terms of equity prices.
Fascinating. You know, we look to the past to help inform the future. It's a normal, well-established part of the way we look at things. But there are new things. I mean, to what extent do you use history? Do you use past shocks and then reflations to guide you? And to what extent is it in fact new this time?
I think the thing that's always the same, and people have heard me say before, it's never different. It's never different from a leadership perspective of where you are in the cycle. The timing can be a little challenging, you know, month to month or even year to year, but the natural flow of handoff from certain styles or certain sectors to others in terms of outperformance versus underperformance, that occurs every cycle. You can look over 100 years of market history and it will demonstrate that. So we are mindful of that from a leadership perspective and what stocks are telling you about, you know, where we are in the cycle. And you can then dovetail that with what we are checking from an earnings and cash flow perspective. So that's never different. What I think you have to be mindful of here is we've never seen interest rates where they are, and we've never seen the amount of liquidity in the system. And when I say liquidity, it's kind of M2 money supply minus GDP growth. That would kind of be the best proxy for liquidity. And what you find is that multiples over history tend to follow liquidity. So times when liquidity is more abundant, multiples tend to move up. When you start, you know, taking liquidity out of the system, then multiples tend to contract, or equities. Now, but the absolute level of interest rates do a lot to your discount rates, right? And so it changes the way you should think about risk in general and how you're going to price one group of assets versus another. So, you know, when you think about, people will say, well, equities look expensive historically. That may be true relative to where interest rates are, not so true. Relative to fixed income, even over 100 years, not so true. Alternative asset classes like gold and, you know, if you want to use Bitcoin or certain pockets of real estate, those asset classes are going to be priced differently relative to each other. And it all has to do with what we're talking about from an interest rate perspective. So I would urge investors out there never to make an absolute price call on an asset class without having some context of where other asset classes are priced and where your interest rates are and where you think they're going to go over time. I think so context is exceptionally important as opposed to an absolute discussion.
Right, where you just sort of get flung out a PE number that sounds right. Extremely rich. Yeah, it's very interesting to have you go through all these things, and I'll just let you know, so many questions have rolled in and you've just answered them as you've gone through things. So there's a whole bunch that have come in, but you've already answered them. One coming in here, just they would like you to expand a little bit more, this investor, on digital currencies. You know, Bitcoin, it's hard to avoid the fact that it's roughly sitting at $35,000 for a Bitcoin right now. Yeah. Any comments?
I'm a novice in my understanding of cryptocurrencies, but I'll do my best. So I've said before, the idea of a cryptocurrency makes a lot of sense. Like it makes a lot of sense from a transaction standpoint. That does. Now, whether you anoint Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency as being the standard, I don't know enough about the topic. I haven't read anything that makes one think that one should be a standard over another. When I think about it, I think currencies should be backed by some group of assets, right? That kind of makes sense. It, at least it has been historically. And otherwise, you get into a barter system, which actually reminds me of what kind of it, that's kind of what I think Bitcoin is. Its value is extracted sheerly from a supply and demand perspective, not necessarily being backed by assets. So I don't know what the FX rates, you know, whether 35,000, 10,000, 2,000, 100,000 makes sense. But if you're pricing it on supply demand, then the intersection of supply and demand should equate to the price. Now, we know supply is fixed or limited,
finite. From gold sitting under the ground that can still be mined, for instance.
Right. But even gold has a more, it's not finite, but it's not infinite either.
Right.
Bitcoin is actually finite, right? You have, I think it's 21 million coins. And then, so you know the supply side. What you don't know is the demand side. But unlike a bar of gold, there are now vendors accepting Bitcoin. So there is a demand aspect as long as people like PayPal or independent vendors actually adopt it as a means to transact. And much like a fax machine, like by itself, one vendor, there's no real value in it. But if, you know, 10 people or 100 or a million people had a fax machine, every incremental person who adds a fax machine, the value of that fax machine goes up. Well, Bitcoin would be the same analogy. Every vendor that adds the ability to accept Bitcoin, the value of that Bitcoin then goes up because demand rises. So you have finite supply and the potential for rising demand. I don't know what that means in terms of price, but that would be the calculus I would use to kind of say, does that make sense? So I can't do a purchasing power parity like I maybe can do for the Canadian dollar or US dollar, but I could think of it more like a supply demand matrix, almost like a commodity that you would barter with. And that's kind of my novice approach to it.
Well, I'd rather have you doing a modest approach to it than, you know, basically anyone else lining up here to do it. But it is fascinating to think of, you know, throw out fashion retail or something, that, you know, a dress or a pair of shoes or something that I might like to buy one day is priced in X bitcoins. But then with the currency, if you want to call it a currency, doing what it's doing, how does that change the value of the actual goods it's trying to sell? I mean, it's going to be a fascinating thing to watch unfold.
Right. And I think, you know, It's perceived as a store of value because it's scarce, right? I mentioned there's a finite supply. The only difference is you can't touch it.
Right.
Like you can go to a bank and you can see gold coins or a gold bar or whatnot, know that your store of value is there, and it will protect you to some degree from all the debasement of fiat currencies that have been going on basically since the global financial crisis. You can't do that with Bitcoin, which Does that pose a security threat? I don't know. Like, so that's why, you know, art, which is a store of value because there's a finite, you know, you have one Van Gogh painting, you have one Jackson Pollock painting. Land is a store of value. It's scarce and it may be more scarce in certain geographies, and that you can touch all those things. You may not be able to spend them quickly or liquidate them quickly, which Bitcoin offers an advantage of, but you can't touch it. And
well,
that's an interesting one.
There's more to say on this, clearly. Just as you mentioned land, what do you think of some of the real estate numbers in Canada? And I know you're not necessarily on behalf of Fidelity going and investing in houses, but I mean, what does that say to you? We just saw massive numbers come up.
Well, I think when the whole work from home world we're living in started back in March for most employers, you saw, and you've seen it throughout the U.S., and you're seeing it to some degree in Canada, this migration away from urban centers, that commercial real estate would take a hit. I mean, that was the initial kind of knee-jerk hypothesis. I don't think there's been anything to suggest that, like I said 9 months ago, I don't think you're talking about the end of an urban center, like the death of New York or the death of Toronto or what have you. But there's going to be certainly some capacity that gets freed up in a commercial sense, and from a real estate perspective, a personal real estate, you know, people will move further away from urban centers if they figure that they can, you know, just to use it, you can, I don't know, live in Sudbury and your employer's in Toronto, because maybe you only have to go in once a month or once every 2 weeks or kind of that. And so there will be some arbitraging of real estate, you know, personal and home real estate going forward. And I think there will be further move out to, you know, more rural areas. And I think that's a natural kind of trend that will take place over time.
Very interesting.
Like I said, I don't think it's I think we have to be very careful of pronouncing the death of like a New York or an LA or something like that, because history is fraught with those types of predictions that never came to fruition. So I would be very hesitant on making such a call.
It's very interesting. And I want to end off with we talked at the beginning about tectonic plates shifting within capital markets. And I wonder if ESG is one of those tectonic plates shifting within capital markets. Only got 2 minutes to answer a very large question, but it's, what do you think?
It is probably the most topical thing we discuss in the investment team over the last 6 to 12 months. If you look at what's happening in Europe, in the Nordic states, continental Europe, also in Asia, with respect to the financial services industry, the asset management industry, there is increasing regulation and documentation that will be necessary for asset managers to fill out, certify, research that will need to be done to explain from several ESG criteria about why you as an asset manager are investing in a given security. And that justification, we've seen it in Europe already happening that if asset managers aren't doing their necessary diligence and documenting it in a way, they won't be on DC platforms for certain European clients. Now, that trend hasn't started in vigor here in North America, whether it's Canada or US. I think it's coming. If you see the way the rest of the world is working, that will be coming to North America probably very quickly. So we at Fidelity have dedicated research along ESG measures and rating systems by ESG metrics internally, much like we do fundamental research. And that, I think, thematically will also impact equity valuations going forward for certain groups of stocks.
There's a lot of new energy that might be put into, pardon the pun, but into this particular area. Andrew Marchese, there's more to talk about always with you. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you again.